problem. So, as I see it, Bill, your greatest way here is to, by some means, find out what voltage is on that battery. And if you find, and by the way, it's not the total voltage on the battery. You want to know the voltage on each one of the cells. If any one of the cells is near zero volts, and you could also confirm with your ohmmeter that there's a short circuit across one of those cells. That's one of the most common modes of failure. That's one of the quickest ways that that poor thing will not run. And the battery, if it is failed, is usually a replaceable item. It may have the sod.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You may have to solder in the new battery, but to bring that thing back to life would give you quite a bit of pride. KC2SYL, K2RIW in the TechNet. By the way, when you do this investigation, and when you finally find out, is it the wall wart, is it the battery, is it some other failure, you've got an interesting case. Please come back and tell us what you find, Bill. KC2SYL, K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2QAQ with one more comment.
Bill first, and then Glenn in that order. Go ahead, Bill.
Thanks, everyone, for the comments. It's basically just a consumer device. It's a handheld back Black & Decker model, 9.6 volts. I've had it for about 5 or 6 years, and I do suspect that the usage is why it died. I actually purchased a new one just recently, same model in Walmart, and I'm very happy with it. Unfortunately, I did recycle the old item, so I don't have the ability to take it apart. But I was very happy with it. Additionally, I had a Black & Decker rechargeable drill, a portable drill, and I had the same issue with the battery and the charger. I called Black & Decker, and definitely it was the battery. The battery had gone, and they were good enough to send me a new charger, and I purchased the battery, and everything is working fine. So I do understand that after so many cycles, the battery will expire or not be usable. And there's no way I can test each cell. Everything is sealed. And Mel, about your comments about opening the case, the wall warts I've seen, they're all sealed pretty well. It doesn't look like you can open them easily. Back to net. And then additionally, I have a question about an antenna.
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
You know, when it comes to a drill motor, and boy, is that a battery that really gets abused. Every one of us, when we're using a battery-operated drill motor, somewhere in the middle of the operation, the battery goes down, and you recognize the fact that the drill motor is running much slower. But it's always at the end of the job, when the last couple of turns of that screw are required, because you're putting a screw into a chunk of wood, and you keep right on going. And boy, are you damaging the battery when you do that. Because most likely one of the cells in series has gone to zero volts. The other cells are still cranking out current. The motor is running slowly, and that one cell that went to zero is now being reverse charged, and it's being damaged. So whenever the drill motor starts slowing down, a smart person will stop using it immediately and switch to another battery. But quite often that's very inconvenient. KC2QIQ, K2RIW. I bet you don't do that with your drill motor, do you, Glenn?
And WS2N still standing by.
Roger, we'll get to you right after Glenn. Go ahead there, Glenn.
Sure, Dick. Just two comments about battery packs. First comment is that the battery packs, most of them, especially all the modern ones today that you'll find in handheld equipment, it's almost unavoidable. If you're operating a laptop, you're on a plane, you're in your car, you're running it, there's no way to plug it in and recharge it, and boop, the battery goes dead. Same thing. You're using a cordless, drill, other device, you're not near a wall outlet, it's going to run down. It's unavoidable. So what basically happens is there's usually circuits inside either the battery pack or in the device itself called a UVLO or an undervoltage lockout, where it takes the minimum voltage per cell, and before the battery discharges beyond a certain point, it either starts throttling back or does a hard cutoff to the point that the device won't operate anymore. Let me let it recycle. Second comment is, what happens in a lot of cases is, yes, eventually, with enough abuse, occasionally the charger will not be able to come back and bring and recharge it, because not only does the battery pack have a UVLO that locks out the operational voltage, sometimes there's what they call an undervoltage startup. So in other words, if the charger thinks that the battery pack's a short circuit, it won't try to charge the battery. In most cases, these levels are never set in the right area, and they do it in the conservative end, because they figure, if anything, you're going to buy a new battery pack. But what I've done many, many times is to take a battery pack that's rated for, let's say, like 3 or 5 amps, and current limit it to something like 1 amp. and then basically put it on a current limited power supply to the peak voltage. Let's say the peak voltage is supposed to be like, you know, a 12-volt battery. I'll current limit the power supply to 1 amp and just put it hard right across the battery pack, and you'd be amazed, Dick, at how many battery packs I've brought back just because the voltage was just a little bit too low for the smart battery charger to start recharging it again. K2RIW, KC2, QIQ.
I hear a signal trying to sign in, but it's extremely, extremely weak, noisy, and very low audio, so I'm not able to copy what the person is trying to say who's trying to sign in. Very glad to hear about that under-voltage lockout circuit. So, in other words, the electronics that have been put into batteries these days are now starting to give protection to the battery. So before you drain it all the way to ground and start doing damage, the electronics connected to the battery is protecting it. I do know that in the case of lithium ion and lithium polymer batteries, let me drop, because if they were overcharged or over-discharged, they are subject to exposure. They can create internal gassing and outgassing and eventually burst the case and do all kinds of damage. So almost all of the modern-day lithium-like batteries have a built-in circuit that protects you from charging it too fast, overcharging it in voltage, or discharging it too fast. And as such, those protection circuits are the main reason why you're not hearing very many stories of lithium battery failures anymore, despite the fact that that electronic protection circuit is there. Nothing in this world is perfect. One of the factories I work at, the whole factory had to be evacuated. This occurred approximately 1 year ago today, because a great big charger on the wall, which was charging a bunch of lithium batteries simultaneously, started outgassing. One of those protection circuits had failed, or the cells had failed, or whatever. And all kinds of crazy gases were squirting out of that lithium battery. The particular laboratory didn't smell good, and they evacuated the whole building until they cleared out that particular...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
So they evacuated that whole building until that situation was cured. It may have been a slight overreaction, but even with that protection circuit, which I know was there on those particular cells that failed, occasionally an additional failure can still take place, but it's very, very rare these days. Paul, first of all, I think you might have a question on the subjects that are on the table, but if not, we're also going to go over to a space report, but before we do, I'm going to make a comment on that. WS2N, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Okay. Just one more comment on the lithium-ion batteries, Dick, and lithium polymers.
You saw on the wall once, Dick. Yes, I have a comment.
Yeah, Eric wants to make a comment. So right now it's Eric, Glenn, and then Paul in that order. Eric, go ahead.
Me too.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up a slightly different subject. If you remember Dave in Massapequa, I think 93HD, he was having problems getting channel 13. I went over there with a spectrum analyzer. Guess what I found?
I'm all ears. Go right ahead, Eric.
The actual signal level is the same as channel 11, except down the corner from his house, maybe 300 feet to his west, there is a cell site, and, you know, channel 13 is 213, 215, multiply that up and you get 880, and in that neighborhood. So along the last mega and a half of the channel 13 signal, all these spikes coming from the harmonic output of the cell site, making it totally impossible for the receiver to decode it.
Wow, let's back up a little bit here, Eric. If a cell site is supposed to be putting out 880 megacycles, and the signal is putting out at 213 megacycles, approximately one quarter of the frequency, is above a threshold that is stopping the proper operation of his digital television demodulator. Do you believe that cell site is meeting FCC requirements? Go ahead.
Well, let's put it this way. The cell site is actually, I think it's TDMA, what they're putting out. So when you look at that on a spectrum analyzer, it looks like a flat line. You know, it looks like noise. But the end result of TDMA harmonic generation, or it could be quantum. I don't think so. I think it's TDMA. What you get is every, I think it's every 20 kilohertz or so I measured, you get two spikes. And that runs for about the width of the entire TDMA signal. So it is that close. He is using twin lead. The antenna looks into the antenna. And what the spikes are, I think, are the differential subtraction of the two components of the signal. So, but it's at a very regular interval, and it's big enough that the
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Interesting story. By the way, you timed out the last 30 seconds. We seem to notice that the timer is a lot faster tonight. Has there been a change in the timing interval, Eric?
I don't know. I'll take a look. Anyway, it's just because of the regularity of those spikes. You know, it only takes a little bit of an impulse to really upset the decoder. And that's why you could bring over any receiver you want. He's never going to get channel 15 with that signal.
If he had a bandpass filter that was only temporarily passing the television frequency range, I mean, it's possible the cell site is meeting all of its emission requirements, but because of the total bandwidth and the total number of signals, that when that simultaneous band of frequencies, strong signals from the cell site nearby his QTH, goes into his electronic front end or goes by the rusty nail that's on his antenna or whatever, that local intermodulation distortion, passive intermodulation distortion, is taking place. And if so, maybe a bandpass filter so that he rejects the cell site signal might be a solution. What do you think is the probability of that, Eric? KE2EJ, K2RIW? 2RIY.
Here's the thing. Okay, I hook the spectrum analyzer straight up to the antenna. That says to me the products have already been mixed, so, you know, those impulses are on frequency, and whether or not you're going to be able to filter them out, I mean, it's possible, but, you know, from my experience, I'd say probably not, but it'd be worth a try.
Okay, go slow now. Yes, the passive signals were there, and passive intermodulation distortion, the so-called rusty nail, in the vicinity of his antenna, could put them there, and then they're coming down the antenna lead. However, your spectrum analyzer, most spectrum analyzers on the first band, 0 to 2 gigs, do not have a Yig preselecting filter. The 0 to 2 gig band is going into that first mixer simultaneously, in which case you might have to, in some cases, plug in, make sure you're plugging in 10 decibels of RF attenuation in front of the spectrum analyzer. With a modern-day spectrum analyzer, it's damn hard to do.
Hang on.
And then does every single signal on that screen go down by exactly 10 dB?
Hang on a second.
You got it. You got it there, Eric.
The spectrum analyzer is designed for doing broadcast television, and I've got 10, selectable 10, 20, and 30 dB pads on the input. I have a pre-selector and a preamp, of which was turned on, not the preamp, but the pre-selector. So I'm actually passing through a filter in the spectrum analyzer before it ever gets to the first mixer.
Okay. Is it your best guess, then, that the cell site is doing that? And do you believe that that particular cell site, if it's doing that, is possibly beyond its specifications for extraneous signals?
Well, I measured about 40 dB down from the main signal, and usually the rules are somewhere between 40 and 60, so they're close, but they should be better than they are, let's put it that way. You know, the guy has cable in the backyard, and I think, oh, well, maybe that was modem signal. You know, if that were the case, then I would be picking up some cable leakage on non-broadcast frequencies in the neighborhood, which would be right above channel 13, and they would probably also be analog, or I would see more, you know, Guam anyway. But that's not the case. He's also got fires in the house. We killed the power into that. That's not the problem. And the only thing left is, you know, what's down the street. So I didn't take a dipole and walk across the street with a spectrum analyzer and watch the signal grow, but, you know, if I really wanted to, that would probably prove the point that that's where it's coming from.
And I think you're saying with that good broadcast equipment, with the right kind of preselector and whatever, and RF attenuation, you're convinced that those extra spikes that you saw had the signature of a cell site signal as opposed to some other extraneous signal with 20 KC spacings or whatever. Is that what you're saying, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, that's my guess. Don't forget, the cell site is a digital animal, and it produces a signal that's several megahertz wide, but because the width of the regular pairs of pulses seems to agree with the total width of the on frequency, the main signal, I tend to think that they belong to one another. You know, they're part of one another.
Do you think he could gain anything by not only using a coax cable, which would be better shielded than his twin lead, but a relatively high gain antenna and rotator, so that he could rotate to the magic position where he improves the television to interference signal to noise ratio? Do you think he could possibly gain something with that combination, Eric? Go ahead. Any chance you want to make a comment on that one, Eric?
A comment on what, Dick?
Okay. There was an extremely long transmission of about 1.5 minutes that had absolutely no audio, and it happened to have your signal strength on the input. Any chance that your mic didn't work during that last transmission?
I suppose that's possible. Let me see. Do I hear myself? Hello.
And you're putting out beautiful audio now. So if you made a transmission in the last minute and a half, no audio was there.
Yeah, I did make a transmission. It was, basically what I said was I recommended to him to dump the twin lead, because that can act as an antenna. Get a little bit better of an antenna and put it on a rotor. And you'll also be able to, you know, see if you can move away from the source of the interfering signal.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I've got to do, and Joe has been telling me for a long time I need a rotator. Paul has been patiently waiting. I know he wanted to make a comment about wall warts. A question. WS2N, K2RIW.
All right. Just for one other thing, most lithium-ion batteries have their own regulators built into the battery case and consumer products. Okay, do you, Joe?
Yeah, and as I said earlier, those regulators are good 99% of the time, but I've seen one of them fail. Paul, WS2N, K2RIW, should I set aside some time for a space report also? You got it, Paul.
Okay, Dick. I didn't prepare anything for a space report. I've been on the busy side, and I haven't really been abreast of the what's new lately. I haven't even gotten on the internet lately. So, now I just want to comment about the wall warts. I've tested, I don't know how many, dozens of these things, you know. I always think something might be wrong. And I always notice it's always like sometimes a volt or two more than what the number says. If it says, you know, it's going to be a 6-volt thing, I tend to get like 7 volts out of it. So just wanted to make that observation, Dick. I don't know if you've ever, you know, no matter what it is, it's always a little bit more. Let me drop it. I just want to make one of the Walmart comments. The My favorite one is, I don't know if they sell these things anymore. It's a multi-voltage unit. You plug it into the wall, and you have six different settings, you know, from 3 volts up to 12 volts, you know, and everything in between, you know, 9 volts, 6 volts, and even, you know, like 2.5 volts. It's really a nice thing. I don't know if they make it, and if anybody knows of it, you know, if they still make it, it would be good to know. I buy more of these things. It's got a plug on the end with different power plugs. You can turn it any which way you want, different sizes to fit different types of equipment. You drop it.
Yes, one L comment.
Switch on the wall wart, which will even reverse the connections on your pins, you know, make the sensor positive and the outside negative, and you throw the switch and then the sensor becomes negative and the other way around. It's really a neat thing. The plug-in or something made it, probably has this thing 25 years or more. Back to you, Dick.
Bill, recognize we're going to go over to you in a minute, Bill. The fact that you measure a little bit higher voltage, assuming your digital multimeter is accurate, doesn't completely surprise me, because your digital multimeter is supplying a load of 10 megohms, whereas the real circuit is drawing an ampere. And there's going to be some, not only wiring line drop, as well as regulator. No regulator is perfect. There's going to be, even if it's an internal regulator, a little extra voltage drop. So no one should be alarmed by a wall wart that says it's supposed to put out 12 volts and you measure 12.8. You know, numbers like that shouldn't alarm you, as I see it, for at least those two reasons. One of the things I want to bring to your attention, Paul, is that, and the group, let me drop, is the August issue of Scientific American 2010 has, is it the lead article? Yes, it's the lead article, if I understand correctly. The lead article is labeled Planets We Could Call Home. Nice article that describes the Kepler experiment. The Kepler experiment is that satellite that was put up last year, which is looking in the Cygnus constellation. It's looking at 150,000 stars simultaneously and looking for the very subtle dip in solar output that occurs when one of the planets around one of those 150,000 stars passes in front of that star, and therefore you get a dip, a very characteristic shape of the dip in the satellite and the star apparent power output as that planet moves in front of the star from our point of view. And so the article talks about the fact that there are many, many planets being discovered. Hundreds of planets have now been discovered around other stars, exoplanets. Let me drop. And the majority of those planets are giant-sized things. And the article goes on to say something that I've never seen before, and that is, when you study how big the Earth could have been and been habitable, it turns out that we're at the lower edge of the size of planets, of Earth-like planets, that are habitable. That the Earth could have been a heck of a lot larger and would have been habitable and still have water, the right gravity, the right magnetic field, and whatever for life to have evolved. So Kepler right now, they're afraid to release the data because they want to wait until they see more than one passage of a planet in front of the star to make sure that there isn't some of the glitch going on. They want to see the real periodicity. And because an Earth-like planet at an Earth-like distance rotates once every 365 years, goes around the star once every 365 days, you have to wait a whole year in order to get the second passage at least. So I know that Kepler and the people monitoring Kepler have seen many potential planets, but they're afraid to announce because they haven't seen the second passage, the confirmation that
repeater, timeout, cancel.
But the article is doing a very good job. The article is doing a very good job of explaining how Earth could have been a heck of a lot larger and been very habitable. Joe is recognized, and there was another person who just told me he wanted to make a comment. The person before Joe, who was that? K2RIW on the TechNet.
And I was waiting to Dick, KC2QIQ.
KC2SYL comment about the charger.
Yeah, that's the guy. Bill first. Go ahead, Bill. So it's going to be Bill, Glenn, and Joe in that order. Go ahead, Bill.
Yes, Radio Shack makes that, the variable charger. I believe it goes from 3 to about 13 volts, you know, for charging. And it comes in, it comes with the connectors, and you can, it's set up where you can, you know, change the polarity. It's about 20 bucks, maybe a little more. I have one or two of them. They work very well. I've used them a number of times. I still do believe it's available at Radio Shack. You could probably check their catalog online. Back to that.
And you may have said it, but tell me again, Bill, what's the approximate price of that thing?
I believe it's $20 to $30, maybe a little more now. I bought two of them several years ago. I think I paid $20, $25 for them.
So, one of the things that's amazing to me is the number of Woolworth and other kinds of power supplies that are thrown out in the garbage every single day at one of the factories that I sometimes visit. My goodness, every time somebody wants to clean out a department, everything that's on the shelf that no one's using at that time, everything goes into the garbage. Somebody's brand new circuits, sometimes in the original packing container, are in the garbage can. And so I develop a little bit of a little bit of a reputation for being the guy that looks into the garbage can, because some of these are awfully good power supplies, you know, mil-spec rating, although commercial grade. Glenn, KC2QIQ, go right ahead, K2RIW in the TechNav.
Hey, Dick, I was just going to mention that with the lithium ion packs and even some of the nickel metal hydride packs, that one of the things that a lot of people don't realize about these batteries are, the reason that they're so difficult to charge is because if you were to raise these batteries to their charge voltage, to their chemical voltage, what'll happen is they'll take a charge, but you're only going to be charging that cell maybe 25 to 30%. That these cells, in order to get them completely charged up to full charge capacity, they require somewhere about 150% of their charge voltage, which is actually quite high. That's why they become dangerous to charge, is with the charges, especially if they don't have temperature cut off and other things, because if these things throttle up to very, very high voltages, yes, you can bump them to their full charge capacity, but you run the danger of actually exploding the battery. Let me let it drop for a second. But unfortunately, because of that, many times the battery chargers aren't smart enough. And what will happen is, if you have a battery pack that sits around for a long period of time not being used, it can actually, because of its own internal charging and little circuits that are inside there, actually self-discharge itself below the startup voltage. So if the charger's looking for 9 volts, let's say, on a 12-volt battery, and it doesn't see the 9 volts, the charger will never start up thinking, oh, this battery could be shorted, and it doesn't want to cause a problem. But what I found sometimes is that if you take a 12-volt power supply for a 12-volt battery, which really, before you're going to run into trouble, you'd have to raise this thing to like 17 or 18 volts, but just to bring it up so that it sees the 9 volts again, you could put like a little 1-amp charger on, like, say, a 3-amp battery pack for maybe 20 minutes, and then just until you see the voltage come up close to 12 volts, plug it back into its regular charger again, and you're back in business, and there's really nothing wrong with the battery pack stick. K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
Glenn, is there any possibility that when the intelligent charger measures less than threshold voltage, 12-volt battery, and it's measuring 8 volts when its threshold is set at 9, is there any possibility that you think the charger is not doing anything, but it's really doing a minor trickle charge to see if the battery is going to come up to the key voltage, 9 volts, where it can go into full charge, as a method of avoiding the overcharging of a shorted cell type situation? Any chance that an intelligent battery pack, a charger, is trickle charging during that time? Or do you think the thing is dumbly just sitting there saying, I'm not going to do anything? Over to you, Glenn.
Well, I've seen both ends of the spectrum, Dick, and this is kind of where I'm coming from. In more than expensive battery packs, like in other words, with a laptop, you might find that the battery pack in there is like a $70 battery pack. Yeah, okay, there that'll have that circuit where it'll actually trickle charge it so that even if it's self-discharged a little bit, the charger is intelligent enough to try to condition the battery to bring it back up to where it can supply a charge again. But when we're talking about like some of these lesser expensive ones, like on the drills for like a Makita drill or something else like that, or an inexpensive vacuum cleaner, and you'll see a nickel metal hydride pack or something like that where Generally, what they're doing is they're just building the minimum charger, and as far as they're concerned, buy another battery pack. And in those cases, sometimes it pays just to take a little power supply, not leave it there, but just hold it on there for maybe an hour or two and watch it, and then just try putting it back on the regular charger, its design charger, and a lot of times it will come back to life, Dick.
That's good to know, Glenn. Another thing I've noticed is that people who have a charger circuit for a battery pack that's intended for, say, a drill motor, quite often they'll plug in the battery to the charger, plug it into the wall, forget about it for 2 or 3 days. The charger may be able to charge the battery in, let's say, 4 hours, 6 hours, and you forget about it for a couple of days. And you come back a couple of days later and you remove that battery from that charger and the battery is very hot to the touch. I know it's doing damage. So many of those chargers, like you say, have nowhere near the intelligence, and you got to be careful. In the old days, there used to be chargers for things like photo flash, and that would charge for a given length of time. And if you're one of these conservative people that discharge the battery pack by 10% and then put it back on charge, and it charged for a given length of time, where maybe the packaged battery only needed half an hour, but it's going to be charged for 2 solid hours at full current anyhow, boy, could you really overdo it. So they all have to monitor something that's going on, as I see it. Paul, I think you want to make a further comment. WS2N, K2RIW in the TechNet. Okay, maybe I've confused. Joe, WA2RYY, sorry to keep you waiting. You got it, Joe.
Wasn't me, Dick, WS2N.
Yeah, you're right, it was Joe. And Joe, are you available? WA2RYY.
Yeah, yes, actually I am. I'm on the internet, so you can hear me full quieting. You were talking about astronomy stuff before. Here's one for you. I don't know if you heard about it this week, but they were searching the heavens, and I forget what constellation they said they were looking at, but they found a sun that is 325 times the size of our sun, which is, I guess they call that one solar unit. Did you hear about that?
Yeah, that was in Newsday a couple of days ago. That particular sun is 320 times the mass of our sun. I forget how many times bigger in diameter. And its total solar output is 10,000 times our sun. Our sun has a surface temperature of around 5,000 degrees Kelvin. And this particular sun, star, they estimate is 40,000 degrees. This thing is a real biggie. Let me drop. The crazy thing about a star is that the star loses its mass because it's converting mass into energy. That's where the light is coming from. It's a nuclear fusion process, a fairly complicated nuclear fusion process. Start off with a sun that is 360 times bigger in mass than the Earth. Common sense would lead you to believe it's going to last 360 times longer. You go through the mathematics, and you'll find out that it's going to last 10,000 times shorter, or 1,000 times, or 10,000 times shorter. The reason for that is the more massive star, by definition, has much higher pressure in the center. Therefore, the nuclear fusion process proceeds at an extremely high rate. That's where all the extra energy is coming from. The star has a hell of a lot more surface area, running at a higher, much higher temperature, so the total energy output is huge. So a supermassive star burns itself out in a short period of time. Our particular sun has a total life of something like 10 billion years. You take some one of these really massive stars, instead of 10 billion...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Instead of a 10 billion year lifetime, it may last for 1 million years, and then collapse and go into a black hole. Ain't that something? Over to you, Joe. W2RYY, thank you for bringing that to our attention. K2RYW in the TechNet.
That was it, but of course, you're right on top of things, so that's good that you saw that article. Very good. I'm going back to listening mode. W2RYY.
Very fine, Joe. My prediction for what's going on right now with the, I think it's called the ROSAT satellite, which is a European satellite, and the American Kepler satellite, they're both starting to get more and more serious for looking at exoplanets, in other words, planets going around other stars.
Connected.
And they're also starting to find out which one of them have life on them. So in the next couple of years, the hundreds of planets that we now know about going around other stars is going to rapidly become a much bigger number. The total number of habitable planets we're going to find is going to go up very, very fast. Whether or not the Earth is an extremely rare situation or whether or not it's a somewhat prevalent situation, right now you can't tell because, let me drop, the detection technique that has been used up till now, the wobble technique, can only find Jupiter-sized stars that are in very close. So, in other words, the testing method has been heavily biased toward Jupiter supergiant-type planets, I should be saying, that are in close to their particular star. Now, with Kepler and other kinds of hardware that's being developed and deployed, we're starting to have the sensitivity to look for Earth-sized planets at Earth-sized distances from their particular star. So the total number of habitable planets that we're going to find is going to go up substantially. And can these particular pieces of hardware detect enough about surface color, surface temperature of the planet, surface composition, what materials are present, is there water in liquid form, is there the right hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and whatever? Let me drop. I've got good reason to believe that we're going to see a lot more potential life habitable Earth-like planets, slightly larger than Earth, because we're slowly discovering, after some guys did a study, and that's what's in this latest issue of the August issue of Scientific American 2010, the people who first did a study of how big could the Earth be and still be habitable, and they find out we're at the low end of the scale. When those people started doing that study, everyone said, what in the world are you wasting your time on that one for? They suddenly discovered these guys were onto something, that if we think that we should only look for our size planet and not one bigger, we're going to be cutting out an awful lot of very habitable ones. Okay, Paul, I wonder if you have any comments to add to this. Have you been keeping track of what Kepler is doing? WS2N, if you've got any further comments, K2RIW in the TechNet.
No, not lately. I've been following some of the other ones, but not Kepler. We're looking forward to some of the other Rosetta by European Space Agency. We have NASA equipment on board that. That's heading out to eventually a goal to go orbit an asteroid and then eventually go over, deorbit that, go to another asteroid. That's quite a project. Rosetta, they call it the Rosetta mission. They just tested that out, and it worked fine on a nearby asteroid. Now it's in the sleep mode until 2014. So I've been following those missions more than the Kepler mission. They did say you're gonna have to wait for the results on that, probably 6 months or ten months after launch. Dick, I don't want to drop it back here.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Your timing was perfect, Paul. I think I heard Bernie just sign it, K2YO. And Bernie, I sent you an email to one of your less popular email addresses. Hopefully you got it. K2YankeeOscar, if you're there. K2RIW on the TechNet. Okay. Was there another person who signed in with a comment, question, or whatever? Give me your call letters again right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
SYL, I had a question about a receiving antenna, if you can take that this evening.
You got it, Bill. Wait for the beep. You got it.
Hi, I just recently received a catalog from heartlandamerica.com. And in here they have a full 1080 HDTV antenna that they're selling for $40, and if you buy it, the coupon is like $30 free shipping. 100 mile range, 20% more gain, and what I found interesting, two directors, two dipoles, VHF, UHF, full channel with booster, low noise, microwave amplifier tube for enhanced resolution. 360-degree rotation and more receives channels 2 to 69, two AAA batteries not included. Just wondering if anyone has any experience with this for receiving antenna for amateur radio and the scanner listening. The range is 45 to 860 megahertz. Back to net.
Now, if this antenna is intended for high-definition, over-the-air broadcast reception, digital television reception, and it's claiming 100-mile range, I think you made it clear that you don't intend to use it for that service. You intend to use it for scanning service. But claiming 100-mile range strikes me as overly enthusiastic. If Eric is available, I'm going to ask him some questions on this. My experience with high-definition television, digital television demodulation, tells me that signal strength and range is only part of the equation. The good news about digital television is that when it works, let me drop. When it works, the picture you get is snow-free. But it's got an extremely sharp threshold. And as you go from being above threshold to below threshold, where it gives you nothing, there's less than one decibel of change. So that if you're and that's just signal strength. I'm calling it signal strength. It really is bit error rate. If in your particular environment the signal is arriving by a multipath, in other words, there's a direct signal path and an indirect signal path, bouncing off ground, trees, water tower, local buildings, whatever, there's a high probability that depending on the elaborateness of the demodulator or the compensator network that's built into your high-def television demodulator, depending on that quality, which is slowly increasing, you could be getting a signal that's 15, 20, 30 dB above threshold, but no demodulation takes place because of the inter-symbol distortion taking place because of multipath. So, first of all, I think a claim of 100 miles is excessive, no matter what the antenna is, unless it's mounted on 300 feet of tower, which is very unlikely.
Oh. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Mounted on 300 feet of tower on completely flat terrain with no other buildings and water towers and buildings and other things nearby, no other blockages. So, Eric, what's your... By the way, Heartland is a company that has some very nice prices, but they tend not to be Cadillac pieces of equipment. Eric's probably got some opinions on this. KE2EJ, if you're there, over Eric. K2RAW in the TechNet.
Sorry, Dick. I heard my name. I didn't hear the question.
Okay, Bill, KC2SYL, is looking at an advertisement for Heartland, which has a $40 high-definition television antenna rated for 100-mile range, 2 through 69 channel numbers, what is it now, something to 860 megacycle, 48 to 860 megacycle range, omnidirectional, got a preamplifier, requires a battery. He intends to use it for a scanner operation. But my main question was that Heartland is not a company that produces a Cadillac equipment. They produce very inexpensive equipment. But the fact that they've got an over-the-air, high-definition television, digital television broadcast ready antenna with preamplifier, and they claim it's good for 100-mile range, and they don't say it, but I'm saying, is that true in the presence of multipath? I think there's probably an excessive complaint, excessive claim. On top of that, what's your guess as to how happy Bill's going to be when he uses that as a scanner antenna?
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
KE2EJ, K2RAW, what's your guess as to how long the timer is set for? You got it, Eric.
Yeah, it was set for 70 seconds. I set it back to 2 minutes. I don't know how it changed. No, let's put it this way. 100 miles, not going to happen. I mean, the curve of the Earth is a problem to start with, so forget that. Digital television's kind of finicky. Most installations where people put in a pre-app, it actually makes the reception worse, not better. I don't know this company, but it sounds like, there's a couple of companies that make these super whoopee-doo round disc pre-amplified antennas that don't work the plastic that they're made out of. But, you know, as far as like being a broadband antenna, maybe.
And then you have to try it and see. K2RW, K2J.
Comment.
Silicon Scientific seems to be the manufacturer, and it's got a lot of directors on it and so on. It's a really interesting looking object here in the photo.
You got any feeling for that brand name, Eric?
And KC2QIQ with a comment?
Yeah, well, I don't know the company or the product, so, you know, it wouldn't be fair for me to even guess, but it just doesn't sound cozy to me, that's all.
Comment. Yeah, oh, we've got both Wesley and Glenn in that order. The eastern tip of Long Island is about 70 miles east of me. I did a calculation once with Earth curvature. How tall would a tower have to be in, let's say, Orient Point, in order for me to be able to see a direct line of sight over the horizon? I think the calculation turned out to be 1,000 feet of tower are required for me to have direct line of sight over a 70-mile range. Just because of Earth curvature, could an antenna really operate for 100 miles in the presence of the multipath sensitivity of digital television? I think we're slowly concluding that's an extremely excessive claim. If that antenna claimed 40 miles, I'd be somewhat skeptical. 100 is way beyond the state of the art. Wesley first. Go ahead, Wesley. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I wonder if there is any chance to see the characteristic of this antenna. It's it does have an eccentric frequency that is tuned to, and then how does it look on the side? That would be interesting, but I believe this is absolutely impossible. Thank you.
It doesn't sound like the antenna has electronic tuning. It's got a preamplifier, requires a battery, and as Eric has told us, many of these antennas with battery preamplifier, when you add that to a digital television reception, it does not make an improvement. Preamplifiers are something you've got to worry about. Unless they're very carefully designed, they're subject of making more intermodulation distortion than real gain and noise figure improvement. And intermodulation distortion could be something that a digital television demodulator could be very sensitive to. So we're not exactly home free on this one.
Yeah, I have a comment on it. The thing is that when the amplification comes within the antenna, then the rate signal to noise is smaller than if the amplification is at the bottom. I wonder how this can... How this is being physically done, if there is any information about it.
Yeah, what you're basically asking is, what's the mechanism by which adding a preamplifier creates a detriment more than a improvement? And it's a function of, is the noise figure of the total system getting better? If it's a well-designed preamplifier, I can give you some slight improvement in overall noise figure with a line-driving preamplifier mounted right at the antenna before the cable loss. However,
you're losing 3 dB per meter.
Okay, you can improve some decibels. However, whenever you add gain, the overall system dynamic range almost always decreases. Therefore, intermodulation distortion is going to come up. And the way intermodulation distortion works, it's a 3-to-1 relationship just for the third order. It's a 5-to-1 relationship for the fifth order. What I mean is, if I add 10 decibels of gain into a system, and everything else that I've added is perfect, the intermod that you used to have just got 30 decibels stronger. Let me repeat that. I added 10 decibels of gain to my overall system. Whatever intermods I used to have just got 30 decibels stronger, assuming that they were occurring downrange from the preamplifier, and the preamplifier was perfect. If the preamplifier itself is a limiting device, then it gets worse than that. So you've got to be a little bit slow about adding preamplifiers. In many cases, they can hurt more than they help. Glenn wanted to make a comment on all of the above. KC2QIQ, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yes, Dick. Actually, a couple of comments on this. One is with the little antenna. Back when this whole HDTV started out, I actually installed a few of these for friends. And one of the advantages to them is they're very, very small. And to get altitude on very modest mounting, you know, to get them up 35 and 40 feet, it's relatively simple. So from that standpoint, I think they're very, very good little antennas. The downside to them is the rotator in most of these cases is like a wireless. And the problem is the higher you put it and the further away from your source, you're not able to turn the antenna anymore. So that's a negative setback. Let me let it drop for a second.
You might have to put an antenna on your house to improve the communication path to your wireless rotator. Back to you, Glenn.
Exactly. And so that was the first problem with them. The second thing, of course, I think I'd mentioned many years ago already, was that the preamps were definitely a detriment. They weren't helping, especially when the receivers were not quite as good as they are today. They've made quite a few improvements on them. But there again, nothing beats a really good piece of coax going up to the antenna. The other thing, too, is that there's another version of it. And if you're going to get the good version of this little antenna, is to get the one that has the rotator function that's like through like a DC coupling through the antenna wire. So it actually uses the coax to send like a digital signal or an antenna signal up through the up through that connection. So it actually allows the rotator function to work a lot better. So that's one thing you might want to ask about, or just look at how the rotator function works in these antennas. But overall, for the price of them and the compact size, it allows you to get them at some really nice altitudes with very, very modest mounting structure, which I think is a plus, because if you try to mount some of these big Vanguards...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Very fine, Glenn. As you can tell, Bill, we're getting a mixed set of answers now as to how good is this Heartland antenna. Lucky for you, you're a guy who, if he spends $40 on an antenna, hopefully that includes a price and shipment, it's not going to be the end of the world if you don't like it, and maybe there's a return policy. For actual digital television reception, Glenn thinks a simple antenna in a good location, high up, is worth the money. I'm not sure it would solve my problem, where I need a directional antenna with a rotator to get rid of the fact that I'm on 300 feet above sea level land with 100 feet of tower, and I'm getting some pretty strong signals from Connecticut on some of the exact same frequencies that I want to listen to, say, from New Jersey or from New York City. And as such, I'm getting co-channel interference at a 90-degree displacement in azimuth from the channel I want to listen to, with my high-gain Yagi aimed at the right at Empire State Building. Let me drop. Say that again, Eric.
In digital television, when you even get a hint of co-channel, it just causes your digital receiver to go nuts.
That's very interesting. Make me a rough guess, Glenn. Eric. If I've got, let me pick a number, 15 dB above threshold in signal amplitude coming from Empire State Building, and I've got a signal that's on the exact same frequency coming from Connecticut, when it comes out of my transmission line going into my digital converter, what's your guess as to how many decibels weaker must the co-channel undesired signal be? If it's 20 dB down, will I survive? Does it have to be 35 dB down before I could clear demodulation? Do you have a rough guess on that one, Eric? Go ahead.
Well, it's not that simple. Okay, you have a front end that is basically trying to extract sync or a clock signal from the digital data. Okay, and if the signal arrives at the same time synchronously with the primary signal that you're looking for, you probably only need a difference of maybe about 15 dB to decide that the stronger signal is the signal. Ah, but if the timing of the signal is, let's say it's off by, 15 nanoseconds or 20 nanoseconds, now you have two pulses where it's trying to extract this clock signal from, and all bets are off. And in a case like that, I would expect it to be at least 45 or 50 dB down before the receiver really gets happy.
Wow. Okay. Now, let me separate frequency domain from the time domain. I'm making a naive assumption that the carrier, I'm calling the carrier, the pilot tone, 375 kilohertz or whatever it is from the low end, that that's the critical signal. I'm assuming that that signal is exactly on frequency, co-channel, and desired channel. I believe that the converter might survive, even though the actual modulation itself, I think, is capable of making co-channel into simple distortion. But if there was a frequency offset between the pilot tone of the co-channel and the desired channel, I suspect that that's a lot less tolerable. I'm now getting an FM modulation or a phase. I'm getting a crazy modulation of two tones meeting against each other. So I'm looking at that in the frequency domain. I think the actual digital television signal has a kind of packet-like characteristic where it also is doing very specific things in the time domain. I think it's the time domain you're talking about when you talk about 20 nanoseconds. I'm back to you, Eric, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay. The reality is that you can kill the pilot, but the TV is still going to work. Now, the pilot is really a training signal for the equalizer. I'm talking about the time domain here. You know, you're thinking of it as a carrier, as you're taking an oscillator and generating a signal that you're modulating, as opposed to considering that there is no, it's sort of like a CW signal that's spread across 6 megahertz, so individual, well, not like COFDM, where you have actual discrete individual frequency carriers that are interspaced with each other. Let's put it this way. In the time domain, where the pulses are, because it is a form of pulse modulation, if you want to think of it like that, how those pulses show up when you try to separate them from one another, because it's got to be synchronously decoded, is where all that effect is. Signal strength, or the total sum of the RF energy.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Okay, I may be wrong on this one, Eric. Correct me, but I think I was up till now assuming that the pilot tone is a frequency reference, phase reference thing that everything else is compared to, so that 341 degree from reference phase of the pilot tone, event A5 has got to take place and demodulation of that synchronously takes place. And if there was co-channel interference on the pilot tone, depending on how much flywheel action there is in, I'm going to call it the phase lock loop that locks into that pilot tone, you can get now phase errors, timing errors, and whatever, frequency modulation errors. So up till now, I've been using that pilot tone as a frequency slash phase reference for the demodulation process. And your way of wording that is a training signal. Maybe there's a similarity between those. Bring me up to speed on that one if you think you can do it without confusing me some more. KE3J, K2RAW in the TechNet.
All right, look at this from this point of view. Okay, I gotta think of a good way to put it. Right. It's all about how the pulses are arranged. Think of it as an NRZ kind of signal, whereas every 19 nanoseconds, you know, I'll look it up exactly, but there's a train of signals, and at the end of that train of signals is a certain state, and that's where you derive the clock pulses from. So the pilot tone itself does not help you with the decoding. It is not like a, it's not synchronous, it's asynchronous, the whole system. So don't think of the pilot as a synchronous, you know, like the pilot would be a clock signal. It's not. It relates to the RF part of it, not the data part of it.
Okay, I'm getting a little bit smarter. Let's assume now that I have no co-channel interference. I'm watching channel 21 from Empire from the local broadcast center, and it's got lots of signal-to-noise ratio above threshold at my demodulator. And now I inject a pure sine wave signal from a signal generator, X number of decibels down from some reference, and I slowly wave that signal across the 6 megacycles. It is my belief that as I wave that extraneous signal close to the so-called pilot tone, that I'm going to get a little bit more disruption of the digital demodulation than if I put it in other locations.